B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Wednesday, June 10th, 2020. A new wrinkle in the complicated case of one-time Trump National Security Advisor and former General Mike Flynn. As you know and we have covered, Attorney General Bill Barr intervened in the sentencing phase of the Flynn trial after Mike Flynn had taken a guilty plea, saying that he had lied to FBI officers when they asked him about his pre-election or pre-inauguration, to be accurate, conversations with the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak. So the judge in the case, Emmett Sullivan, decided to investigate Bill Barr's remarkable move, calling for the charges to be dropped. And as we have discussed in our in-depth interview with Scott Ritter, who changed my mind on this issue, there was at least a technical reason for Bill Barr to argue that the charges should be dismissed. And it related to the original national security investigation into Mike Flynn that started in July of 2016 and then morphed into this investigation of the questionable calls with the Russian ambassador. So Emmett Sullivan engaged a guy named John Gleason, who is a retired judge himself. He was once a prosecutor who busted mafia dons. And he issued a 73-page brief to the court today. The government, quote, has engaged in highly irregular conduct to benefit a political ally of the president, said John Gleason. Leave of court should not be granted when the explanations the government puts forth are not credible as the real reasons for its dismissal of a criminal charge. Now, one of the issues that arises here is that Mike Flynn, under oath, agreed to plead guilty, and when questioned by the judge, under oath, he said, yes, I did lie to the FBI. So his change of plea and the shift in arguments by the new lawyer team that he brought in puts him at risk of a charge of perjury because both claims could not be true, right? So Gleason said that Emmett Sullivan should take the behavior into account when imposing a sentence on Flynn, but does not argue that he should be held in criminal contempt of court for lying to the judge. More from Gleason's brief. The Justice Department has treated this case like no other, and in doing so has undermined the public's confidence in the rule of law. I respectfully suggest that the best response to Flynn's perjury is not to respond in kind, ordering a defendant to show cause why he should not be held in contempt based on a perjurious effort to withdraw a guilty plea is not what judges typically do. So, the other wrinkle here is that the Flynn team had already filed an emergency appeal with an appeals court that turned around and told Judge Sullivan that he needed to explain to them why he hadn't already dismissed the charges. So this now becomes a game of pickle between the trial court and the appeals court that appears to have intervened prematurely. So this now becomes a very complex, it was already, but a complex case that was on its way to completion. After all, this is all part of the jockeying over the sentencing phase of the trial. So Gleason also wrote, the government's grounds for seeking dismissal are conclusively disproven by its own briefs filed earlier in this very proceeding. They contradict and ignore this court's prior orders, which constitute law of the case. They are riddled with inexplicable and elementary errors of law and fact. and they depart from positions that the government has taken in other cases. Now, while I narrowly agree with Scott Ritter that there is a basis for these charges to be dropped, I also understand that the legal process is being turned on its ear. This is an extraordinary move to dismiss the charges at such a late stage. And we will see what Judge Sullivan does to sort this out, to appease the appeals court. And I just have one other note, and that is Judge Gleason had in some ways compromised himself because he wrote and published an op-ed before he was assigned by Judge Sullivan to investigate this whole situation with Bill Barr's intervention into the Flynn case. But we also saw Barr intervene in the case of Roger Stone. And so nobody is clean as a whistle or pure as the driven snow. And I'll just note that Bill Barr, of course, before he was made the Attorney General to succeed Jeff Sessions, he had published a lengthy argument against Trump being impeached or disciplined in the Russiagate scandal. So it's hard to find a clear side to take in this whole dubious process. And I await further developments in what I see as the unraveling of the Russiagate narrative. We know that the fundamental claim that Russian agents hacked the DNC was never proven by CrowdStrike, and the admission by Sean Henry, the CrowdStrike executive who led the DNC server investigations, that they had never been able to prove that the information was quote-unquote exfiltrated by Russia or anybody else. And if that is not true, that Russia hacked the DNC, then the foundation of the Russiagate narrative, of St. Bob Mueller's limited hangout investigation, it all collapses as well. So today in Washington, the Federal Reserve and its chairman, Jerome Powell, announced that they are not going to change interest rates, which are at near zero, and offered some pretty pessimistic economic projections. Now, we have to insert here a point that the unemployment figures that were released last week are unreliable. It appears they were doctored, and we're still trying to get to the bottom of that. And so it showed the unemployment rate, oh, I don't remember exactly, but in the lower teens, like 13%. Well, the Fed says that they expect the unemployment rate to end this year at 9.3%, remain elevated for years, coming in at 5.5% in 2022. Output is expected to be 6.5% lower at the end of this year than it was in the final quarter of 2019. And Powell said nearly 20 million jobs have been lost on net since February. The downturn has not fallen equally on all Americans. And the new forecasts predict a much slower path back to economic strength. And, of course, Trump is trying to cheerlead it into high gear in time for the November election. But even more troubling news from the Federal Reserve is that they made some changes to what is called the Main Street Lending Program. It's described as lending money to mid-sized companies. And they expanded the definitions so that companies that can now qualify include oil producers and frackers. And they're making the claim that it was the stay-at-home order that led to lower gasoline consumption that led to their economic woes. But the oil industry and the frackers in particular were already on their knees by February, before COVID became a significant factor to the economy. And that was due to the worldwide oil glut and the struggle between Russia and Saudi Arabia about who might reduce production first and how far they would reduce it. Then by May, we hit that point where oil futures were at zero or underwater. So I don't doubt that the COVID, the pandemic lockdown, and its impact on our economy further damaged these oil-related firms. But they're lining up for bailouts, suggesting that, oh, you know, it was all COVID. So on Monday, the Fed announced it will give borrowers an additional year to repay the low-interest loans, 5 years instead of four. Companies will also have a holiday on making payments on the principal, 2 years instead of one. But get this. It also allows heavily indebted companies, the highly leveraged ones, to refinance their existing debt. And the Fed is basically taking virtually all of the risk. Previously, it was only accepting 85% of the risk, and now the Fed said it'll buy 95% of the loans, with banks taking on, a minimal risk. And this absorption of risk, the Fed is encouraging the flow of credit to firms already saddled with debt. So we're bailing out a bunch of deadbeats in an industry that should be allowed to go bankrupt in the interests of fighting climate change, and just being honest that the frackers in particular have hit the point of diminishing returns. But there's the Fed being prompted by Senator Ted Cruz and other supporters of the oil patch. And once again, their losses are being socialized, meaning that you and I, the taxpayers, will shoulder them. But their profits, when they had them, were not shared. They didn't take out insurance policies or business interruption coverage. No, they pocket the profits and they saddle us with the losses. Interesting piece at The Intercept today under the byline of Lee Fung. You may recall a couple of weeks ago, Adam Eichen and his colleague Andrew Perez joined us to discuss the so-called HEROES Act. This was the Democratic-written legislation for the next round of relief money from Washington, and it passed through the House on a Democratic party-line vote. And it's got a lot of great stuff in it, including relief money for state and local governments that's badly needed. But it also has some really stinky stuff in it, like writing the rules so that lobbyists and trade associations qualify for bailouts, to some extent at the expense of legitimate nonprofits and small businesses. So a new survey conducted for the Democratic Policy Center, that's the new advocacy group formed by Eichen, Perez, and others, shows that 48% of Americans strongly or somewhat strongly oppose any legislative effort to reward corporate lobbying groups with coronavirus stimulus money. 34% support it. The poll also asked respondents what types of stimulus efforts should be prioritized, with 70% of Americans expressing opposition to making lobby groups a major focus of economic relief. And that 70% number cuts across independents, Democrats, and Republican voters. Adam Eichen is quoted, "The growing momentum in Congress to bail out virtually all corporate lobbying groups has been absurdly justified on the grounds that local chambers of commerce need assistance." And so, I see that the momentum is building for the opposition that was started by Eichen, Perez, and his group. But as the House bill has been on ice, the Senate has not taken it up, and they're not showing much inclination to do so at the moment. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas has drafted his own effort to extend PPP money to trade associations, and Democrats like Mark Warner and Tim Kaine, both of Virginia senators, they have issued statements in support of that. So that tends to show us that there will be Democratic support for bailouts for lobbyists and trade organizations, and that should be enough to carry it in the Senate. And Fung notes that last month, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned restrictions on Paycheck Protection Program money based on a range of criteria that include strip clubs and lobbying firms by taking an expansive interpretation of the CARES Act as intended to support any business concern. But the ruling is limited to the state of Michigan, where that particular lawsuit originated. And one more quote from Adam Eichen. "This polling shows that Americans oppose the efforts in Congress to let corporate lobbying groups benefit from coronavirus relief funding, even if the measures would help local chambers too. If members of Congress want to do something that the American people support, they should prioritize offering more direct funding to individuals and families, which is overwhelmingly popular." And Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary and former foreclosure king here in California, he made some interesting noises telling lawmakers today that the next round of economic stimulus legislation, so first of all, he's saying there should be more relief coming out of Washington, must be targeted to help industries that have been hit hardest by the pandemic and creating incentives to get jobless workers rehired. Well, one of those incentives is to cut the amount of the federal contribution to unemployment payments of $600 a week. Now, if you're truly unemployed, that's a big kick in the pants. There might be a handful of people who say, well, you know, I can make a little more on unemployment than I can going back to work. But they know that that's going to end at the end of July. So this idea that we got a bunch of fatheads who want to lie on the couch and watch Ellen all day long, we have to, you know, curb their behavior through punitive measures. But what's interesting here is the industries that I think need further relief the most are state and local governments. And here in my community, last night, the school board had to prepare for massive cuts to their budget, comes out of state funding, because it's so uncertain what future they face. 60 positions are on the chopping block. And this is part of a process that can be reversed if the federal money comes through and the state passes it along. But it is very difficult for the education industry, if you will, to even plan as far as September. And there will be additional costs to adapt to COVID, smaller classes, maybe even staggered schedules, more distance learning, and so on. A little bit later in our daily COVID-19 update, we'll talk about the states that are showing an increase in identified cases of COVID-19. But for now, I just want to single out North Carolina and Florida, which are both described as having persistent growth. And over the past week or so, every day, the number of cases continues to rise. So as you know, Trump is bullying Charlotte, North Carolina, which was to be the site of the Republican National Convention in August. And he's basically saying, if I can't have a big crowd of people who don't wear masks, then I'm just going to bully you and find a place that'll host our convention under my rules. So Jacksonville, Florida, appears to be stepping up, with, of course, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, who barely imposed any restrictions in Florida before reopening. And cases are on the upswing there. Who knows where it'll be by August? But the idea that Jacksonville is in any better position than Charlotte to host the convention? Not based on data, friends. Nope, not at all. Every day I like to remind you that the listeners of this podcast, and your humble host, have contributed to the Peter B. Collins Community Fund. And we are offering $100 grants to individuals who can use a Benjamin to help cover the gap between your unemployment check. Maybe it hasn't arrived yet. Maybe you'll never get one. So if you're short of cash right now, you don't have to, you know, send me a balance sheet or your bank account to current balance. Just send me an email and say, Peter, I could really use $100 right now. Here's why. My email address is peter@peterbcollins.com. And I'll say at this point that we are well-funded for the level of demand that we have seen, so I'm not asking for any more contributions. But we have several thousand dollars in the account, and we will give it away until that amount is depleted. Today at the House Judiciary Committee hearing on police brutality, Philanese Floyd, the brother of George, offered some powerful testimony. Quote, "They lynched my brother. That was a modern-day lynching in broad daylight," he said. People was out there pleading, please, please, get off, he can't breathe. People were video recording it. Nobody cared. Nobody. Floyd called on police departments to stop hiring corrupted police officers. You're supposed to serve and you're supposed to protect, he said. I don't see that anybody was protecting and serving that day when his brother was killed by an officer's knee to his neck. And in reaction, Minneapolis police are making additional moves. They've banned chokeholds already. And today, they announced that the department will withdraw from police union contract negotiations. The chief of police, Madaria Arredondo, said that the contract needs to be restructured to provide more transparency, flexibility for true reform. He said this is not about wages, bonuses, or salaries. He said, this is a first step toward transformational reforms to the embattled agency in the wake of George Floyd's death last month. This is about examining those significant matters that touch on things like critical incident protocol, use of force, the significant role that supervisors play in this department, and the discipline process to include both grievances and arbitration. So this is loosely part of the effort to that's, you know, behind the slogan, defund the police. And I think most people have learned not to take it literally or totally literally, but that it's an easy, you know, three-word sentiment that expresses the need for drastic overhauls of the departments and their policies. So one of the laws, we talked about this yesterday, that has protected officers with a history of misconduct. In New York State, it is Section 50-A of the Civil Code. It's been on the books for decades. And it allows the police to keep the disciplinary and personnel records of officers secret. And last evening, the state legislature, and I don't have the vote counts in each house, But it is described here as the repeal of that section of the law passed through the state legislature in Albany, and that Governor Cuomo has publicly indicated that he is likely to sign it. And this is a big change. Activists and police reformers have sought to repeal the law for years. Just 1 year ago, those efforts went nowhere. The state legislature, even under a new Democratic majority, declined to change or repeal it. Mayor de Blasio in New York, whose administration has interpreted 50A more strictly than his predecessors, said he supported changes to the law, but he didn't spend any political capital to make them happen. So this is change driven by grassroots pressure. And we need to keep that pressure on. Likewise, the legal concept of qualified immunity, which lets cop off the hooks for responsibility for all kinds of things that can include police misconduct. Well, in a case in West Virginia, a federal appeals court invoked the recent death of George Floyd, denying legal immunity to five cops in West Virginia who were sued for shooting a black man 22 times while he lay motionless on the ground. Now, the story is a little complicated, but it's interesting that the ruling, the unanimous three-judge decision, was written by a judge named Floyd, Judge Henry Floyd of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the panel decided that to dismiss the case against officers who shot and killed Wayne Jones in 2013 would signal absolute immunity for fear-based use of deadly force, and we cannot accept that. And the decision continued, although we recognize that our police officers are often asked to make split-second decisions, we expect them to do so with respect for the dignity and worth of black lives. Before the ink dried on this opinion, the FBI opened an investigation into yet another death of a black man at the hands of police, George Floyd, in Minneapolis. So here's a definition. Qualified immunity, the legal principle that has long shielded law enforcement officers and city officials from civil liability for excessive force and civil rights claims, has gotten fresh attention in the aftermath of Floyd's death. And in this case, the man named Jones was apprehended because he was not on the sidewalk. He was walking in the roadway. And he appeared to have mental issues, cognitive issues. And at some point after they wrestled him to the ground, one officer used a chokehold to restrain Jones. One could be seen on video kicking Jones on the ground. And then one of the officers noted that Jones had produced a pocket knife and managed to at least get a glancing blow in on one of the officers. And that's when they formed a semicircle around who was on the ground. They ordered him to drop the knife. He didn't respond. He lay motionless. And then they pumped 22 bullets into Jones. Well, that's clearly excessive force. And it looks like there will be an effort at accountability there. So we've talked about for the last few days the brutal shoving of 75-year-old Martin Gugino in Buffalo by cops who were trying to clear an area under curfew. And this led to Trump's tweets suggesting that Gugino could be a provocateur for Antifa and that he didn't fall that hard, so it looked like a setup. And it's nice to see that people who know Gugino have come to rally for him. Victoria Ross, an activist in Western New York who has known Gugino for 10 years, said the ludicrousness of the lie, just a nonsensical allegation. She's the executive director of the Western New York Peace Center, where Gugino has volunteered for years. She said that a lot of lying and fabricated fabricated misinformation was going around about her friend. And I was pleased to see that my friend Andy Worthington, the British journalist who has devoted the last 20 years of his life to exposing our gulag at Guantanamo Bay, well, he has known Martin Gugino for some years. He said Martin is an implacable peace protester, but a very gentle man. And many people have asked why Twitter, which has pretended to crack down on Trump, didn't flag this post or remove it. After all, it did suggest things that appear to be flatly false. But the way Trump worded the tweet, call it clever or not, but he was really just speculating. The language, Buffalo protester shoved by police could be an Antifa provocateur. So could be is a weasel phrase, and you can't call that a lie. It is an inaccurate suggestion. Continuing to quote from the tweet, 75-year-old Martin Gugino was pushed away after appearing to scan police communications in order to black out the equipment. Well, again, appearing to. The idea that he had some gizmo that could black out unnamed equipment doesn't add up. Nevertheless, it's not quite an outright lie. Then Trump says, I watched, he fell harder than was pushed, was aiming scanner. Could be a setup, question mark? So Trump knows how to, you know, he's a bad boy. Always has been. So he knows how to get his message across without quite triggering any further crackdown from the management at Twitter. Also, Bill Barr's role in the week-ago Monday clearing of the streets near the White House so Trump could make his bold stroll over to St. John's Church for the photo op with the Bible. Well, that and other responsibilities that were handed to Barr, the management of the federal officials, law enforcement officials' deployment on the streets of Washington. Well, this has led to nearly 1,300 former Department of Justice employees signing a letter addressed to the department's inspector general asking for an internal review of Bill Barr's handling of street protests, including his role in the crackdown on peaceful demonstrators outside the White House a week ago Monday. Quote, in particular, we are disturbed by Attorney General Barr's possible role in ordering law enforcement personnel to suppress a peaceful domestic protest in Lafayette Square on June 1 for the purpose of enabling President Trump to walk across the street from the White House and stage a photo op at St. John's Church. Now, at the White House, the new press secretary said it was Attorney General Barr who made the decision to clear the street. And he's tried to wiggle out of it, saying, well, you know, I just told him to take care of it. And I think this could be payback, in Trump terms, for the recent comments by Barr on Fox News that Trump went to the bunker for security reasons on May 29th, not simply to inspect it, as he has tried to claim. Now, I've only seen snippets of the TV show called Cops, and I always found it revolting. It glorifies strong-arm police activities. It demonizes criminals, painting them all with one broad brush. But I can happily report to you that after 32 seasons, Cops has been canceled. Ah, that's a great sign of the times. And I don't even know if America's Most Wanted is still on, but that's an ugly show. And then there's a new series based on the FBI, and I believe influenced, if not fully controlled, by the FBI, that's currently on the CBS network. And somewhere they're still running reruns of To Catch a Predator, that ugly show that NBC ran as a series, where they would entrap people who tried to date younger women and showed up at a trap and got taken down on camera to the delight of voyeur viewers. So in the last few days, some Confederate monuments have come down in Virginia, and I believe also in Alabama. And there is talk about renaming a handful of military bases in the South that are named after Confederate military leaders. But Trump, he won't take a knee to that. Quote, "These monumental and very powerful bases have become part of a great American heritage and a history of winning, victory, and freedom." What's that got to do with the Confederacy, Don? He went on, as he does, "The United States of America trained and deployed our heroes on these hallowed grounds and won two world wars. Therefore, my administration will not even consider the renaming of these magnificent and fabled military installations. Our history as the greatest nation in the world will not be tampered with. Respect our military." Yeah, right. Should have put a Confederate flag with that Twitter post. Meanwhile, the independent State Department Inspector General who was fired by Trump after Mike Pompeo requested it, that's former IG Steve Linnick, he told Congress the two senior officials tried to block an inquiry into the arms deal with Saudi Arabia. That was opposed by the Congress, and it went through after the State Department intervened and just kind of forced the issue. So Steve Linnick said he was also looking into the allegations that Pompeo and his wife may have misused government staff to run personal errands. He was fired late on a Friday night, May 15th. Quote, "I was in a state of shock because I had no advance notice of anything like that. I had no indication whatsoever." Linnick said he had opened a review of last year's $8 billion arms sale to Saudi Arabia at the request of lawmakers who claimed that Pompeo had inappropriately circumvented Congress to approve the deal. That's probably the last we'll hear from Steve Linnick. As I mentioned earlier, the reports indicate that in 21 states that have reopened, the number of cases of coronavirus is shown to be increasing. So Yakima County, Washington, shows 1,100 new cases since the beginning of June. In the Phoenix area, more than 4,000 of Maricopa County's 14,000 total cases are from June alone. In Arizona, one of the state's largest health systems, Banner Health, is reporting an increase in patients on ventilators since the beginning of the month. So there are serious concerns that the renewed activity, the post-lockdown, the early exit of some states is going to produce a continuing increase in the numbers. But I've got to say that I'm deeply frustrated by the way the media delivers these numbers, because they never put them in a context like the number of cases per 100,000. We don't get per capita numbers. We also don't have a clear idea of how much increased testing is producing increased identification of cases. And we also don't have any clear idea of how many cases have led to hospitalization, ICU transfers, and ultimately death. And so it's easy to scare people. It's easy to paint a picture that, this virus is spinning out of control. And while there are troubling increases in some areas, including California, I don't think that any kind of alarm is indicated at this point. I would change my view if I had the data that I just described, and it showed, serious increases, particularly in hospitalizations. Here's today's COVID-19 report, organized by Linda Lewis. Worldwide, the death count is now up to 414,000 COVID-19-related deaths. In the United States, the number has crept up to 110,000. And on Capitol Hill in a Senate hearing, the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee has forced the release of data slides related to FEMA's acquisition of PPE. And in particular, surgical gowns remain in short supply. The document slides show that domestic manufacturing of gowns and surgical masks has ticked up by a few thousand per month, falling far short of the need. The U.S. still does not manufacture nitrile rubber gloves. These concerns come amid a growing increase in demand for PPE as states reopen and elective surgeries, dental procedures resume, and the public is buying a lot of masks. The ones I see are not the N95 versions that are appropriate for hospitals and other medical facilities, but I do see some out there. Democratic Senator Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire demanded that the information be made public yesterday, and questioning the FEMA administrator, Peter Gaynor, at the hearing, Hassan accused the agency of dodging questions about how many N95 masks and other protective equipment will be needed throughout the duration of the pandemic. Also, the U.S. government will fund and conduct key studies on three experimental coronavirus vaccines, according to Dr. Anthony Fauci in an interview on CNN. He reported that Phase 3 trials, which typically involve tens of thousands of people and measure whether a vaccine is safe and effective, will begin with one by Moderna in July, then an Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine in August, and one by Johnson & Johnson in September. Each of these Phase 3 trials is expected to take place at more than 50 locations, mostly in the United States, and the trials will each include about 30,000 people. The European Union is accusing China of being behind what they call a huge wave of false facts, disinformation about the coronavirus pandemic. The European Commission said Russia and China were running targeted influence operations and disinformation campaigns in the EU and globally. Now, while this charge has been laid before, this is fairly new from an EU official. French politicians were furious when a Chinese embassy website claimed in mid-April, at the height of Europe's pandemic, that care workers had abandoned their jobs, leaving residents to die. The unnamed Chinese diplomat also claimed falsely that 80 French lawmakers had used a racist slur against the head of the World Health Organization. So this marks a change in tone by the EU after lawmakers in the European Parliament accused the Commission of watering down an earlier report on disinformation under pressure from China. The Commission also issued an implicit rebuke to Donald Trump as it noted the harmful effects of his bizarre suggestions about injecting bleach to treat coronavirus. Without naming the U.S. president, a Commission document stated that such false claims can be very harmful, noting that Belgium's Poison Control Center had recorded an increase of 15% in the number of bleach-related incidents. Well, I think that number's higher here in the United States. And at Mint Press News today, Raul Diego recaps the recent statements and then recantations by top officials at the World Health Organization, including a statement by Maria van Kerkhove that transmission of COVID-19 via asymptomatic individuals is, quote, very rare. So, You could say she walked back her statements or she clarified them. What I didn't report yesterday, said Kirkov, was that because there's so many unknowns around this, some modeling groups have tried to estimate the proportion of asymptomatic people that may transmit, and some estimate around 40% of transition may be due to asymptomatic transmission. And I didn't include that in my answer yesterday. So she got spanked somewhere in the last 24 hours. Also, the report tells us that Professor Keith Neal, he's an epidemiologist and expert on infectious diseases at the University of Nottingham. He conceded that the role asymptomatic transmission plays in the total number of new infections remains unclear, but symptomatic people are responsible for most of the new infections of COVID-19. Now, the article also recaps what we reported yesterday, that on June 7th, Forbes magazine published an article with the title, Norway Scientist Claims Report Proves Coronavirus Was Lab-Made. And unfortunately, the article was taken down from the Forbes website, and a friend supplied me with links to the Wayback Machine at the Internet Archive. And I was able to pull up the document, but as I attempted to read it, it, poof, disintegrated on my screen. So it is considered so toxic to discuss or explore whether the coronavirus was made in a lab or originated in nature through animal-to-human transmission. I don't know the answer. But when we see articles like this posted and then removed and covered up, it doesn't promote trust and credibility. Well, yesterday we gave you the early report on voting in the Georgia primary. It was a mess, and it stayed that way all day long. In key precincts, people waited up to 3 hours to cast their vote. And many people were there, they said, because they had applied for mail-in ballots, but they never arrived back in the mail. It's really ugly. And as we mentioned yesterday, this followed purges of voter rolls and the last-minute introduction of new ballot marking devices that variously were not available. Some were still in the box. Poll workers didn't know how to set them up, how to instruct people to use them. And so the irregularities have prompted the Republican Secretary of State to say, oh, yeah, we're going to have an investigation. And finally today, there are reports that Russian bombers maintaining international airspace have been buzzing the coast of Alaska. And U.S. fighter jets intercepted Russian bombers twice on Wednesday, off the coast of Alaska, according to NORAD. This comes less than 2 weeks after American bombers were met by Russian jets over the Black Sea. And I stress that Russia didn't violate our airspace, but it's clear they weren't just, flying to get a bullseye view of some of the great features in the state of Alaska. Now, separately, Moscow has invited the United States to join it for disarmament talks, nuclear disarmament talks. Russia has confirmed it will open discussions with the U.S. this month on extending a major nuclear disarmament treaty that Trump has signaled that he is ready to exit. And we'll see how the greatest negotiator ever sizes up the situation and what he decides to do. But I think it is in our best interest to be talking with Russia. My fear is that Trump, I don't have much confidence in the guy, but let's say he negotiates a screaming deal and Russia disarms, the U.S. gives up some nukes because of Russiagate. the false narrative that is cemented in the brains of too many Americans who all they need to do is hear the word Russia and it triggers an end, or at least temporary interruption, to rational thinking. So I'd like to see us get a new deal and deal with the new generation of Russian weapons, which, if they live up to the hype, could leapfrog ahead of the United States. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You are free to share it with absolutely everyone. I hope you will. You'll find it on YouTube. And I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.